Hi, everybody. This is Ray Otis, and you are listening to Plundergrounds. Today's episode is a bit of an experiment. I went completely without an outline and any kind of script whatsoever. I just had some ideas I wanted to talk about, and I talked straight into the phone. So there's a lot of kind of verbal flubs and fills, and I'm not going to edit any of it. I don't think it's too bad. I hope I don't try your nerves too much with my ums and you knows and so's and all that. But I talk first about dice and why dice are great randomizers, or at least why they're the most popular randomizers that we use in role-playing games, how they're ultimately kind of better than cards or other things that we might settle on. And then I go into table love, where I talk about different kinds of tables and how dice mechanics interact with tables, and how you can use tables to create effects and drama to replace some of the lost dimensionality of dice. So I, for instance, mentioned that cards have more dimension than dice, but somehow aren't as well suited to gaming. And then I go into talking about right-sizing mechanics for combat and how dice mechanics kind of become meaningless on the overly simplistic end and the overly complex end, and what you really want to do is sort of pick mechanics that best support whatever kind of dramatic moments you want to create at the table. I hope all of it makes sense. I know it's a little bit all over the place, but I'm counting on you, my good listeners, to make sense of it, because I do think there's some good ideas in here, and this is a conversation, not a proclamation. I'm not the be-all, end-all expert. I don't even know if I'm an expert on anything, for crying out loud. So when I get on my soapbox and talk, I'm just talking like we would talk over a beer at the gaming table. And I hope if you have significant thoughts where you want to correct me or add to what I'm saying, that you'll call in and tell me about it. I was thinking about dice as randomizers and why they're so attractive. First of all, why we use, you know, dice in role-playing games primarily, as opposed to cards and chips. And I mean, there's all those things exist in role-playing games, but they're just not nearly as ubiquitous or popular as dice. Dice have not that many dimensions to them, you know, so each die has a specific number of sides. The sides are quite often numbered to the number of sides. So like the most common die, will have, like, well, obviously the most common die is a die six, with six sides and six numbers, one through six. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be a cube with colors on the side, or a cube with symbols on the side, and you see those used in role-playing games. But of course, that means some kind of special production and makes them harder to get. So, you know, when we play with dice, polyhedral sets are probably the most common randomizers in role-playing games. Why is that? Well, they're universal. They started with the original game, you know, D&D, so that has something to do with it. They are super portable, which makes them better than like a deck of cards, because decks of cards, by the way, you know, they have so many dimensions. They have colors, they have suits, they have numbers, they have ranks, they have, you know, the ability to pull out a card as you do randomization, so that you are reducing the pool of results that can happen. Card counting. There's just all different kinds of things you can do with cards that you can't do with dice, but they're not nearly as portable. And that's funny to say, because a pack of cards will fit in your pocket. So I think it's also that they require just so much more manipulation, because you're constantly shuffling or whatever. People tend to mess with card decks. They tend to put decks together, or I saw a guy make six suits one time by taking two decks of cards and putting them together and drawing a line with a Sharpie through the hearts on one set to make Valentine's, and then drawing a cross through the diamonds on one set to make kites. So you had three colors, red, black, and red and black, and then you had six suits, the regular four plus kites plus Valentine's, and then he threw away the extra spades and clubs. And I thought that was really cool, but of course that requires, you to go out and sort of make a specialized deck. So we all have this kind of common pool of polyhedrals to share. I think most people have a set of polyhedral dice, or can get a hold of them pretty easily. They have, other than their dimensions, I guess, in terms of shape and sides and number, which is really the same dimension, they do have a kind of a physical dimension. So you see that used in die drop tables where you put people will draw things on a piece of paper. The easiest form of this you can think about is if you drew different sized circles on a piece of paper and wrote things in the circles that you want to happen. Let's say they are random encounters. And in the big circles, you put more common things. In the small circles, you put less common things. And then you throw a die down onto the sheet of paper, and wherever it lands, that's the result you get. But also not only the result you get, but maybe if you're throwing a D6, one means just like a sign of something that's about to happen. So if the D6 hits an owlbear and it comes up a one, you find some owlbear poop. But if a D6, you know, comes up a six, then you run right into a nest of a pair of mated owlbears and their eggs, right? So you can have both, you can have two dimensions there. You can have both the result and the severity. And if you've ever played around with the One Roll engine, they use dice they use a pool of dice to get both, height and width out of them. So there is ways to force dimensions onto dice, but they are pretty simple things. They just kind of, you know, give you a number out of a range of numbers. And so it's all about, you know, kind of tweaking the percentages to figure out what kind of odds you want on things and what kind of dice you're going to use. So not overly like amazing as randomizers, but super, super, super reliable and super portable, super durable, fun to collect because they're colorful or can be. And just something that we all have in common. So I think, you know, the underappreciated die, this is an ode to the die, if you will. I also want to talk about how different tables are structured with dice. There's all different kinds of ways to use dice to create tables. And this is part of the love, I think, for old school games, which is how many random generators there are in these games to help you pull up content out of your subliminal spaces. And, you know, basically it gives you a result, and then you kind of have to add to that result to kind of bring it to life. The first random table that I can remember in my experience with Dungeons & Dragons, I don't remember any tables from Holmes Basic, which was my first set. I'm sure there were some in there, but I just don't remember them. I do remember, though, I went from Holmes Basic pretty quickly to the AD&D books as they came out. And I remember the Random Dungeon and the Dungeon Master's Guide. Of course, there was all the random monster tables and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, and the magic, you know, treasure tables and all that. But the one I really loved was the Random Dungeon table for solo play, because I lived out in the middle of nowhere and often didn't have friends to play with. It's really pathetic, isn't it? And I would roll up my own little dungeons and kind of, you know, crawl through them, one room at a time, so that you were always surprised. And I think, to me, that's where, at least for me, that's where the kind of random table spirit was born in old school role playing. And of course, it has exploded in recent times. And I mentioned recently on a podcast with Spike Pitt that I think there has been a serious revolution in how tables are built in the last 10 years. You see interesting tables before that, but you don't see there's just so many out there now, so many good tables. So let's talk about a couple. One of the ones that I like that isn't particularly obvious, and I'm not sure where this comes from, it feels like it comes from the Warhammer side of the equation for some reason, is a D66 table. And a D66 is, you roll 2D6, and the first one is a 10s, just like you would roll 2D10 to get 1 to 100. So 2D6 are still going to give you 36 results. Is that right? But they're going to be in 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, you know, not 17, you can't get 17. So you'll get, then, you know, the reverse of those, 61, 62, 63, 64. So you can get all those. Now you can also do it, where I've seen it, where the lower die is always the tens die, which creates a different kind of distribution that's interesting. And I think that only has 21 results. Either way, doubles are twice as rare as any other combo on those tables, because there's no way to flip. You know, if you get a six and a six, 66 is 66, no matter how you read it. You can't get, it doesn't matter which way it comes up. So it's interesting, and those are kind of cool tables to build. Die drop tables, I've already mentioned. There's a neat table that I like where you take, I want to call it a scaled table, let's say. So let's say you have a table that has 12 results, and they represent dungeon rooms from a really easy encounter to the boss fight. Number 12 is the boss fight. And as characters move through the dungeon, you start them off with a D4 or a D6. And so they're the first couple rooms they encounter are going to be from those first results on the table. And then maybe if they go downstairs or they get a key or something that kind of unlocks the next level of complexity, you give them a D8. You step them up a die. Now they can get results from the next, you know, highest rooms. Another way to do that, and you could go all the way up then until they're rolling D12s, which then they have a chance to run into the boss fight. But then it's random, so you don't know when they're going to hit each room. You could also do that with just a regular old D6, but as you get a result, cross it off. And then when you roll a result that's already crossed off, you just step up one. So that's a way for making a table where the more rare results are kind of reserved for later. Of course, there are curved tables, you know, so 2d6 gives you a curve, so you can always make, you know, 1 and 2 and 12, the most rare results, and the middle of the curve, obviously more common. And a lot of cool things I've seen old school people do is, you know, as you roll on those tables and you encounter something, you just scratch it out and put in a new one for the next time you roll that number. So there's not a lot of repeats, or no repeats if you don't want there to be, you know, and the dungeon feels like a living organism that constantly replenishes itself or changes itself. So that's cool. What else? There are, well, percentage tables, of course, which allow you to play with the ranges so that not all results on the die are the same. And whether that's a percentage table where it's literally you're breaking up 100 or 1,000 or whatever you're going to, you know, however many units you're going to have and how you're going to roll that. Or if it's just a D20 table, but you have results like results 2 through 5 are one thing, but results 6 is another. You know, that gives you different distributions or commonalities of things. Boy, I had another one in mind, but I'm kind of blanking out now. I'm going to pause for a second here until it comes to me. Okay, I remembered what it was. There's a cool article that I read online, and I'll link it in the show notes, called Hex Power Flower. And basically, it showed, it was bigger than a mega hex. It might have been a hex that was, let's say it's 5 cells across, or 6 cells across. And you start rolling in the center hex of the table. And the number you roll leads you out one of the 6 sides of the hex. And this table used a curve, so you were rolling 2d6, but you could do it flat with 1d6. In the 2d6 version, the more common, there was like a common side of the table and a rarer side of the table. So you kind of progressively moved toward or away from these rarer areas. You kind of moved around that table, as it were. So the table has itself kind of a map-like physical, geographical presence that was really cool. And it's kind of hard to explain, so you just really ought to look at it. And it gives you an example of one way where you can get tables that have that kind of influence themselves, that have progression to them, have evolution to them. So that was really smart. And if you have other tables that you really love that are just really weird or different or do different things with dice than you've ever seen before, please tell me about them. I have almost kind of collect these in notes and in my brain, just because I love to see different ways people that use tables, and especially when they're really elegant. Oh, we've mentioned before the tables in Maze Rats are a really elegant way to do a D66 table. So they Ben Milton, when he wrote Maze Rats, he has all these tables in there where you roll 6 on the x-axis and 6 on the y-axis, as it were. You've got basically, let me explain that better. You've got groups of words in 3 columns and 6 rows per, am I explaining that right? Yeah, there's 3 columns and 2 rows, essentially, to the table. And in each cell of that table, there are 6 results. So imagine you see a little block of 6 words, and then you skip your eye to the right just a little, and there's another block of 6 words, and then you go right again, there's another block of 6 words, and then you go down to the next row, and you've got that same grouping of 6 words, 6 words, and 6 words going across. So rather than numbering the table or putting lines or anything, you just roll 1-6 and go across the top. So 1-2-3-4-5-6, 4-5-6 being on the second row. And then you roll D6 to go down that, the results in that cell to get the word you want. And it's just a really simple and elegant way to present the tables, and a space saver, a huge space saver. So I thought that was really cool. If you've got an elegant example of a table, I want to hear about it. The other thing I'll say is, going back, I re-listened to the first segment before I recorded this one to see what I had missed or screwed up. A couple things. On the D66 tables, doubles are as likely as anything else on the, if you don't have the low result be the tens every time. If you do have the low result be the tens every time, yes, the doubles are twice as rare as everything else, because you can't flip them. Another thing about dice that are cool, that are better than cards, is that they scale really well. So the randomness of dice doesn't change. And it doesn't have memory like cards, of course, which I mentioned. But, with cards, let's say you have a deck of 52 cards and you have four players, you add another player, that kind of changes how often you shuffle and how many cards get passed out and all that. So you have to kind of adjust decks to the number of players at the table if you're going to use them as randomizers, or think about how they, you know, how big you want the deck to be reasonable. So that cards are more problematic is what I'm saying. They're not as easy as dice in some ways. And they're not as flexible, ultimately. Like, even though they have more axes to them, you can just do so many things with the way you create tables that you're creating the complexity on paper in the table rather than having it built into the randomizer. Okay, I think that's it. I think that's what I wanted to say about dice and tables. I love dice. I love tables. I think we all do, as long as tables don't get in the way. I guess I'll say that tables are something they often use before the game, not during the game. And as much as I love Dungeon Crawl Classics and I love the tables in Dungeon Crawl Classics, there are times when I feel like the dice tables at the gaming table can be a little weighty, you know, that you're constantly kind of looking things up, critical fumbles, critical hits, spell results, lay on hand results, everything's kind of table driven. And it does feel like a lot of lookup. You can internalize a lot of those pretty quickly. Certainly like the critical hits and the lay on hands and that kind of stuff. But even so, I don't really care. That's the only thing I probably don't like about the system, is that it's a little table heavy during play. But I love games where they give you a lot of ways to roll up content to prepare for a session. So when you're getting ready to create a session, actually the first time, I think the first time I ever just ran a session from random tables, other than that, you know, solo play like the Dungeon Generator and stuff I was talking about before. I used to do a lot of solo wargaming where you have kind of programmed enemies and things. We'll talk about that at some point, because I want to talk about small hex encounter games at some point. But the first time I ever ran a session based on a random table, in other words, I rolled up the source of the adventure at the table, like minutes before the game, and then ran with it, was Inspectors, which explicitly tells you to do that. There's been a meme going around. Oh man, I hate the word meme. Sorry. Whenever it comes out of my mouth, I just feel gross. but there's been a common popular, what the hell? There's been a meme going around the social media for the last couple days about the 10 most influential games for you personally. And I had to put Inspectors on mine because of two things. One of them is that they have a mission generator at the beginning. So you roll some D6s and you get different results, and it kind of tells you who your client is and what the disturbance is and where it's at and all that kind of stuff. If you don't know Inspectors, it's a little bit like a .com startup game mixed with Ghostbusters, and it's super cool and very well written, very tightly written. It's by Jared Sorensen, and it's been around for at least 10 years, probably 15. Just a great game. All right, that's the first time I ever just ran a session rolling up the table, and I loved it, and I've done it a lot since then, just because I like that having to think on the fly and use player input. Colin calls it sourcing the table, which I love, and you just kind of all build the fiction right there. There's no way to sort of build a heavy load and bring it to the table in terms of a bunch of baggage that you're going to try to force onto the players. You just have to live in the moment. All right, the other thing, just because I've said it and now I got to fit it in, is the confessional mechanic from Inspectors. That's the other thing that I really love about that game. And I'll talk about it more in a future podcast, I think, because I love that mechanic. It has one problem in that it's kind of tied to this idea of a reality show. So the confessional works like this. You're playing along in the fiction, things are happening, and somebody kind of basically puts pause on the game by getting up from the table and going and sitting in the confessional chair. And you can think of it like if you've ever seen The Office or any of these other mockumentaries where things happen for a while, the story goes along, and then you see a person being interviewed and they're commenting on what just happened or what's about to happen or just adding a side note or whatever that's humorous. So this is basically what you're doing, but with role playing. You get up, you go to the chair, and you know, then you add a piece to the fiction that everybody has to work with. And it's really cool. It makes it really fun. You know, you could get up, maybe you're in a factory, a bread factory, having a fight with vampires, and somebody gets up from the table and goes and sits in the chair and says, you know, if I'd have known that Gregory was allergic to flour, we wouldn't have tried to sneak into this factory, you know, and then you go back to the, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, so now Gregory's sneezing and coughing and whatever, or just has a debilitating, you know, racking sneezes that he's trying to suppress. And you have to work it into the fiction, and it's really cool. I ran a game of old school Star Trek with it one time. I called it Inspect Trek for my mashup. And I had one of those toy communicators set in the middle of the table so that whenever somebody wanted to do a confessional, they grab the communicator and flip it open, and it would make that cool original Star Trek communicator sound. And then they would talk into the, like they were, you know, recording something for the captain's log or whatever. And then we'd work with that in the fiction. It is a little gonzo. It's a little, you know, it can lead to a certain type of play that you may not want. But I have successfully kind of pulled that into other games at times as a way to bring players into the fiction. It may not be your cup of tea, but it is a really interesting mechanic. And so that's one of the reasons it was influential to me. Not at all related to dice and tables, so I've wandered from the point, but hopefully it's something that you enjoyed. Okay. So much for that. I apologize for all the you knows and ums and at any rates or whatever else I've, what other filler phrase that I've stuck into there. You know, for sure. I think I said you know, but I'll say it 5 more times because, you know, I like to say you know. If you're a podcaster, you know the pain of this. Trying to eliminate that stuff from your speech is so, so hard. So is another one, right? So is an ands, tying all your things together with so and and. But we're all trying to get there. That's natural. Oh, wow, there's another one. When you make that clicking noise with your mouth when you're considering something. Cody M says he likes to leave in the lip smacking. So here you go, Cody. This one's for you. There. That's all the mouth noises I can make off the top of my head. All right, now I'm getting silly. I'm going to end this segment because it should have ended 10 to maybe 30 seconds ago. Hope you enjoyed. Once more into the breach, I found that I have just a little bit more to say about tables. Tables can provide drama. So I mentioned the Hex Power Flower, and the example in the article that is the one that sort of drives the article, or at least begins the article, is called Where Does the Rot Grub Go Next? And so if you know old school D&D, I think it's still around, probably rot grubs, but you know, these things get under your skin and in your system, and then they drive towards vital organs and will kill you in a few rounds if you don't do something about them. And so this table was basically, you would roll every turn to see where the rot grub is headed in your system, and it might go to lesser harmful areas like your extremities, your fingers, your feet, whatever, or it might drive straight towards your brain or your heart. And I just love that idea of the drama of, you know, watching this thing travel around your body as you're trying to figure out how to get it out. And that's where I think if you are clever with your tables, and maybe if you make them, they can become like a mini game within the game. And you don't want to go too crazy with that, because obviously that can pull you out of the fiction, and it could be overdone. Just like anything, it can be overdone. But if you do it right, it could be really fun. So at tables for drama, think about that. And it leads me to another thought about dice mechanics and combat that I heard from Dungeon Musings. and which is a great podcast, by the way. So I'm going to pause here and come back and talk about that just in a different segment. Dungeon Musings is a podcast that has recently come onto the scene. I think he's only on episode 4. His name's Kevin. I can't remember his last name. It's just so good. The first episode was talking about how he and his group were playing Barrow Maze, and they were playing it with, what were they playing it with? 5th edition or something? No, Pathfinder. And it just became a little too much for them, and they decided they want to, they had a, what he called ludonarrative dissonance, which I think is a great word. It's a, you know, obviously the tension between the game system and the kind of fiction you want to create, ludo, game, narrative, story, dissonance, tension, right? So great term because it explains itself. And I don't know why I just then spent 2 minutes explaining it to you, but and so they switched to Scarlet Heroes, which that was a cool call. And then he got a call in from somebody, was it Rich Frazier from Cockatrice Nuggets, maybe, or DM Dad? Somebody called in and said, you know, is it a case where we're talking about whether it's an old school versus a new school thing, or whether it's a crunchy system versus not crunchy system in terms of complexity in combat and making every combat the same, you know, the kind of sameness. When you start having these long drawn out combats, a lot of combat mechanics, then combats start to feel a little bit unspecial because you're spending 80% of your time in combat. So it all just kind of blends together and can kind of make boss fights not as exciting maybe. So there was a whole second episode of Dungeon Musings on that. And I thought that was really cool. But as I was listening to it, I thought, you know, you can sort of illustrate this for yourself very quickly. So whatever game you're playing, I don't care if you're going to play on a 5-foot grid, you know, if you're playing on a map and you're, you know, try thinking about it this way. What if every combat you had with a monster was decided by one roll of 1d6? And let's not even put math into it, like you're better at combat or you're worse at combat and pluses and minuses. Let's just say if you roll high, 4, 5, 6, you win. If you roll low, 1, 2, 3, you don't. Okay. And you just die, right? Like, let's not even do wounds. Let's just say you kill or be killed, d6, right? That might be a little silly, but let's just say you're out of the fight or something if you roll low. And, you know, if you did that, and played the game, combats would be over so fast. They would be dramatic for sure. They would be so dramatic that you'd be probably pissed, you know, because it's just a crapshoot and it would all feel a little meaningless, right? In the end, because you don't really get a chance to influence that die. I heard DM Dad say on a recent episode, which I loved, that he doesn't like skill rolls because if you go to the dice, you've sort of failed, right? Like it's because you haven't really described what you're doing to the GM in a way that would make the GM reveal the piece of information that you need to get to. So like if you're looking for traps, if you say, all right, I'm looking around the base of the room on the wall and looking for stones that are discolored or don't seem right. And, you know, if there's drains there or trap doors, you know, maybe say, yep, you find, you know, on sure enough on the west wall, you know, you find a discolored stone, what exit, you know, that indicates there's some work there. You know, that you don't need a roll for that. Or the non-dramatic way to do that is you walk into the room and go, I search for traps, and you roll a d6, and you just, you know, you go with the roll. So there's kind of an in-between to this stuff, right? But he said going to the die was, you know, he liked to work in the fiction as much as possible, and it doesn't mind spending an hour having players try to work their way through, like, a trap room. And I don't either. I think that's kind of cool. It can get a little cumbersome, maybe, but there's a time to maybe call for the roll. But, you know, knowing when that is always tricky, right? So, which kind of brings us back to dice just a little bit. But I'm losing my train of thought. Oh, so in combat, let's, you know, you got the other end of that spectrum, which is combat can be so involved that even combat between like a third level character and two goblins can take multiple rounds. You know, just because of the way the mechanics work, that it's just a lot of rolling. You can have misses. You can have a miss for low damage. You can have special moves or bonus actions or attacks of opportunity and all this kind of stuff that come into play. Where this relatively, you know, should be a simple fight between like an experienced fighter and a couple of crappy, you know, untrained goblins should be kind of mowed down, or maybe he takes a stab in the leg while he's killing one before he kills the other or something like that. becomes like this 20-minute fight or 15-minute fight, even a 5 or 10-minute fight. And so those mechanics can get super heavy and kind of, I want to say weigh down the combat, but just make the combat more involved, because some people actually love that stuff. That's what they want to do, is play that kind of tactical game. And so I think you have to find where you fall on that range, and it ought to be dictated a little bit on how dramatic you want combat to be in comparison to other dramatic parts of the game. So, I think the old school way of playing is that you have very simple mechanics for combat and you have almost no mechanics for anything else. So if you're going to argue with the king to fund your adventure, that's not going to be a roll. You're going to argue and the GM is going to decide. He might make a reaction roll, based on how persuasive your argument is or something like that, and modify it. But you're not going to roll a skill, you know, as a character. You're not going to roll your diplomacy skill or whatever to see if you get away with that. And one great thing about that is it forces the fiction in the way that I think Dungeon World forces the fiction, which is to say you have to play it out. You can't just walk into the room and say, all right, I try to convince the king to fund my adventure, and you roll the die and name your skill. And, you know, if it comes up, you expect the GM to say, yep, he agrees. That's just so much shorthanding, right? You're flying past all kinds of important things there in the fiction. And so I guess that I'm really rambling here, but what I kind of want to say is, you know, use the mechanics in a sensible way to support the drama. If you want drama, make them play things out. If you want to shorthand something, go ahead. Use the dice that way. You might use the die. Well, the random encounters in the wilderness are that. You know, you don't want to maybe describe hour after hour of traveling through the wilderness, although you should give that a bit of a nod, right? I'm going to really window out here just for a second. Hang on. I know this is like story time with your weird old uncle, but Tolkien, one of the things that people don't like about Tolkien is all his long passages about the travel from one place to another. But I love that because it makes me feel that the world like really is big, or, you know, that it takes time to get from one place to the other and it's not easy to get there. So back to my point, if you're doing overland travel, you're going through a hex or whatever, and the GM describes the terrain and says generally what the weather's like and how the day goes, and then the GM probably just makes a roll behind the scenes somewhere to see if something happens, right? To see if there's any random encounters that pop up. And that's okay, because they shorthanding, you know, like a whole series of players asking like kind of meaningless things like, do I notice any sounds around in the wilderness? Are there any tracks on the road of people who've been here before? You know, I mean, that's fine. If they want to ask those things, you can supply details, but you're not in a dungeon crawl, right? There's a time and a place for that kind of heavy exploration, inspection kind of thing. And it has to kind of scale up and down with the fiction at the time. So I have given you no useful advice, I think, in this whole segment, other than just to observe that there is a range, and the range gets absurd on either end. So if we're talking specifically about combat, dice mechanics get absurd if they're so simple that they just feel like a coin flip that you can't influence. And they get absurd if they're so involved that you have to go through 18 different hoops to get to a single exchange of arms. You have to think about meaningfulness in roles. So it's equally meaningless to have 18 different modifiers. That's why 5e went to the advantage and disadvantage, because, you know, plus 2, minus 3, plus 1, double, minus 6, like all the stuff that you would do with third edition started to become meaningless, right? You just sort of going up and down the scale till you settle on a number. And D&D 5e just says, hey, are you generally at advantage or are you generally at a disadvantage that's notable here? Otherwise, just roll your stinking D20, add one modifier to it. So, I like where they've gone with that. My point being that it's meaningless to have too many mechanics and it's meaningless to have too few, because after all, this is a role-playing game and you don't want to just decide everything in verbiage, in talk. If we just played a game where you say, I attack the goblin and this is how I attack him and it's really cool, and I as the GM say, yes, you do that and you stab him through the heart and he's dead, or no, the sword bounces off his armor and he doesn't die, after a while you might go, how are you deciding this sort of thing? And as the GM, I get a little dissatisfied because I'm just deciding everything. I like the dice to tell me sometimes what happens. And so we use dice to surprise, for the surprise factor, and for the drama, but just keep in mind that it's not dramatic to roll for everything or too many things. And it's also not dramatic or interesting to not roll for anything or to have such simple mechanics that they just don't, you can't come to grips with them. I've repeated myself a lot there, but I think there's a point in there somewhere. Maybe you can call in and tell me what that point was and illuminate me and say it in like a pithy, you know, five word sentence or something. All right. Have a good one. Okay, it's time to fit in a few call-ins. First, we have my friend Jim from Indiana, who is going to read us his favorite poem, since I read you one of my favorite poems in the last episode, and I love it. It reminds me very much of my experience as a parent, or more accurately, my wife's experience as a parent. It's a really cool poem, and he has linked me to the full version, which I will put in the show notes. So here's Jim.
Ray, I love that you shared your favorite poem, and the night imagery reminded me of my favorite poem, Late Night in Bed by Gregory Janikian. It was just the beginning, but I highly encourage people to read the rest. My wife tells me she hears a beetle scurrying across the kitchen floor. She says that her daughter is dreaming. Too loudly, just listen. Her eyelids are fluttering like butterflies. What about the thunder, I say? What about the dispatches from the police car parked outside, or me rolling over like a whale? She tells me there's a leaf falling and grazing the downstairs window. Or it could be glass cutters, diamonds, thieves working their hands toward the latch. She tells me our son is breathing too quickly. Is it pneumonia? Is the furnace suddenly pumping monoxide through the house? So when she says, my wife says sleep, she means a closing of the eyes, tuning of the ears to ultra frequencies. It is what always happens when there are children, the bed becoming at night a listening post, each little ting forewarning disaster. Downstairs there's a sound of something brushing against something else, and I try to listen as my wife might listen. Insects, I say, dust on the tabletop. Maybe a knife's edge against the palm.
Thanks for sharing that, Jim. I know it's a little awkward to read a poem out loud sometimes, so I appreciate that. And I can totally see why that poem is meaningful to you. I know that in many ways you're all about your family, and it's just it's such a cool experience, isn't it? That speaks really to the parent in all of us, and this neat contrast between the big noises that are unimportant and the tiny, tiny noises that might be your children in trouble or a threat to your home and household. So very cool, very cool. Next up, we have Spike Pit.
Hi, Ray. It's Colin, Spike Pit. I heard your call in to Happy Whisk talking about you don't learn about cooking and baking through cooking and baking. And some of the stuff you said about wanting to give back some of the love you've received by creating food, and kind of the idea of this reciprocation of good times, and it got me thinking about why I run games. I've had so much fun playing in games over the years, and when I was introduced into games, that is definitely the main driving force behind like doing the podcast and running games. You just want to sort of return the favor, I guess, and pass on the enjoyment.
That is exactly right, Colin. I often think of hosting a role-playing game the same way I think about putting together a Thanksgiving dinner for a table, right? So you put a lot of love into what you're bringing to the table, and what you get back from that is watching people enjoy it and really dig in. And another part of that is, and I'm going to refer back to one of your earlier episodes called Sourcing the Table, which was a really great episode. An aspect of that is, and we're going to stick with the food metaphor and Thanksgiving, is knowing who's at your table and what their favorite dishes are. So if you just cook a dinner and then people come in and sit down and you don't think about your guests at all, you just, you know, they sit down and maybe you got a vegan at the table and you got somebody who basically only likes meat and potatoes, or somebody else who is on a diet, and you've put the spread in front of them and it's not suited to them and they don't enjoy it. And then you get mad about that and you think how ungrateful, and, you know, go off on a little rant in your head. You kind of were asking for it, weren't you? Right? So one of the reasons for sourcing the table about what kind of games people want, what kind of things they want in their games and the characters they want to play and how they want to see those characters in action and all that matters, because in the end, it's not about you and your meal. It's about bringing a meal to the table for everyone to enjoy so you can have a great time together and, you know, have an experience. Right. So I know that, like, I used to help my grandmother cook Thanksgiving dinner, and she would let me help make my favorite piece, you know, my favorite bit, which probably at the time was mashed potatoes or baked beans, although we didn't really have baked beans for Thanksgiving. But man, I love baked beans. And I'm really windowing out here, but one of my favorite things about traveling to England was they have baked beans for breakfast. And I was like, yes, baked beans for breakfast. That's what a great idea. And cottage cheese. I love cottage cheese. All right. So. But you know, that's what it's about, isn't it? Right. So just as my grandmother let me help make food for everybody, cause I thought that was fun to make food for everybody, and also fun to make my favorite thing. So I knew my favorite thing would be at the table. That's how we should think about sourcing the table. When we get to the gaming table, we should let players help us come up with the kind of experience that is going to best suit everybody. So everybody's going to have the most amount of fun that they can have. So I appreciate that call in. And I do think experience is the best teacher. You know, people that have given us that gift, that have let us be part of the fiction or have given us moments to really shine as a character and really showcase our character and then given other people the same, you know, moments so we can appreciate their characters too. They teach us how to do it right. And all the advice in the world and books, it may be extremely good, or advice that I give here on the podcast may be extremely good, but it's not nearly as good as thinking back to a game master who just did something particularly well. So I'll mention one, for instance, Mike Evans, who's a game master and the creator of the Hubris setting, also Death is the New Pink and probably some other stuff that I'm forgetting. But I've played with him a couple times at Gen Con, and one of the things I love about the way he runs the game is he's just super physical. He stands up, which a lot of GMs stand up, but he acts out a lot of the elements in the game and makes weird noises and, you know, boggles out his eyes and all that kind of stuff. Reminds me a little bit of your son, actually, Spike Pitt. I feel like I'm talking to you now instead of making a segment on my podcast. But you know, being super animated as GM, and that I walked away thinking, not only was this a great game, but I should do more of that, right? Like, some of those noises were really effective, and some of the motions he made were really effective, and I should do that to help convey what's going on in the fiction to my players. Okay. So thanks for that call in, both Jim and Colin. And Jim, you've kind of inspired me. Maybe I'm going to do some more poetry in future episodes, but I'll probably work harder at reading them so that they really get their due. I'm not as good a reader as Colin is or some other people. I have, I'm going to go into my Midwestern apologizing for things, but I don't think my voice is all that well suited to being melodious and something that people want to listen to when they hear poetry. But I'm going to do it anyway. So maybe I'll start writing dungeon poems the way that people on NPR and elsewhere write cowboy poems, right? We'll start have haikus about dungeons or something. All right, cool. Thank you all for enduring this very strange podcast. I do think there's some nuggets in here. If you can find them, you just might have to dig a little harder than you would in one of my more organized episodes. This is Ray Otis signing off, and you have been listening to Plundergrounds. You can find links to lots of stuff at my page, www.rayotus.com. That's RAYOTUS. And it's a really simplistic page. It's just basically lines of text that link you to various sites that are a little more fully developed of things that I mess around with. And so you can find all that there. The opening and closing music was You Can Use Me by Captive Portal. Until next time, look out for rest monsters.
Cannot have a meaningful campaign if you do not keep strict time records.